I'm a recovering alcoholic. My voice has all of a sudden decided to crap out on me. I tend to mumble, so I wore the loudest shirt I could. It's surreal being here in this building in particular. And I'll tell y'all about that at the end. I grew up in Austin. To a very religious household. We moved around a lot. My dad was always getting a house just outside of his means, and we would lose a house and have to get another house, and it was always around North Austin. But we did move around a lot. I have this little timeline here, and the first thing, my first attempt to manage my own life was by running away from daycare at four years old, and it was also the first time I got pulled over. I was walking down the highway at 4 years old and got pulled over by the cops, and they asked me where I was headed. I said, "I'm headed home." "So where's home?" I said, "East." He said, "Well, where east?" I was like, "East." So that was the whole thing. I went to the police station, and parents came. We got in big trouble. The next memory I have from when I was young was this epiphany I had, I guess, when I must have been about 6 or 7, and we went to California and went to Pirates of the Caribbean, and we went on this ride, and it was all immersive, and like it was like you were a pirate in a cave, and I was into it, you know. And when we got to the end of the ride, it came out, the boat came out under this night sky, and I looked up and I saw that the night sky wasn't a night sky; it was just a black ceiling with holes in it. And I took that all the way to nothing is real, and everyone in my life is just playing a part just to fool me. And I asked a counselor later in life what that thought process was, and without hesitation, she said, "Oh, that's narcissism." So I caught that early. The first time I got to where I never felt okay. I was very shy. I always felt out of place. The first time I ever got any relief from that was I was about 13 years old, and the cool older chick across the street had some alcohol, and I went over there, and I remember drinking a little bit of vodka and then waking up on her floor. But I woke up on her floor, you know? And so I sensed that this stuff had power. And so I proceeded to steal as much as I could from it, from all the relatives, and drank all throughout middle school. And eventually I found LSD, and LSD was my first true love. It was my answer to my parents' religion. It was a way for me to connect with something that I didn't feel from them or their God. I got my first 2 sheets of Flying Eyeball when I was 14 years old. I ate most of it. The problem with LSD is you can't do it every day. Like, you want to do it every day, but it just doesn't have the same effect. So it's better if you wait a few days. And so I started having to do other things, one of which was huffing Freon with the neighborhood kids. And I should have picked someone else's AC, but I huffed all the Freon out of my parents' AC, and it burned out the compressor. They didn't have the money to fix that. So for 3 years, my parents would just be sweating in the middle of the summer, and they would just wipe their brow and look at me and go, you have to keep using after that. Like, you have no choice. That's the only thing you can do to deal with all that shame, you know. So at 15, I had a car accident. I was hit by a car on a skateboard and thrown 40 feet, flipped 3 times in the air, landed on my head and my shoulder, crushed every rib on my right side, broke my shoulder, bruised my heart, and collapsed my lung. And the lady tried to sue me for the windshield. Yeah. My dad lost his business because of the hospital bills and all that. So, again, more shame, more guilt. I started selling LSD. I was the high school acid dealer. It's just what that was my purpose in life, you know. And I did that for a while. And again, I started to try other things. I had just gotten a lot of acid, and I went to a party, and it was the first time I ever tried cocaine, and it was amazing, you know. And I was still up the morning after the coke. I took acid, did coke, and was still up at my parents' house in the morning. And I got a call, and it was some guy that I didn't really know. And he knew some guys that I definitely didn't know. And he said they wanted some acid. So I said, well, all right, tell them to come to my window, you know. And they get there, and I was kind of paranoid about selling it out the window because it was the middle of daylight, you know. And so I was like, yeah, just come on in, you know. And there's two guys, and I was trusting. I was an acid dealer. What was I worried about, you know? So one of the guys said, can I see the print on it? And I said, sure. And I handed him 5 sheets. And he said, thanks, and put it in his pocket. And I stabbed him 13 times. Mm-hmm. I'd always heard, you know, you can do whatever you can to stop someone from robbing you in your own house, but evidently not for drugs. And you're not supposed to chase them down the street, stabbing them. So at 18 years old, I found myself in maximum security in Del Valle Jail. For a murder charge. They didn't know that he was going to live, so I was arrested for murder. And luckily, he did live. And I got very lucky, and my court-appointed attorney was an amazing attorney. And he stayed on my case for 2 years, and he got me 10 years deferred probation. So 10 years deferred probation was easy to manage being a drug addict until the first UA. And that sort of set the course for the entire probation. But I would be honest with them. I'd be like, hey, you know what? I'm just not going to, I don't think it's going to be clean, you know. And they'd thank me for being honest and say, you know, do you need some help? No, I got it, you know. And I would fail over and over and over. I started selling coke and all kinds of drugs downtown. I got lost in the clubs downtown, 6th Street, while on a 10-year deferred probation for attempted murder. And I just wasn't doing too well at it because I kept doing all of my product, you know. And I remember putting a question out there in my mind. I was like, why can't I? You know, all my friends seemed like they were doing a great job at it, you know. They were making a lot of money and stuff. And I was just waking up with hangovers and empty pockets. And I remember putting the question out there, why can't I make this work? And something said, because you weren't meant to live this way. And I was like, well, whatever, I'm going to keep trying. And so I did. I met an amazing girl in a club, and it was love at first acid trip together. You know, like, it was amazing. She was amazing. I found myself in jail on a violation for stealing the senator's daughter's car. They don't like that. The DA was acting like it was his car, you know, because he really wanted this conviction because it was a senator's daughter's car, you know. And so he recalled the case 40 times in 8 months. I went to court 40 times in 8 months, and that will drive you literally insane. And meanwhile, I had this amazing girl on the outside waiting for me. You know, there's no atheists in foxholes. I didn't believe in anything, but I prayed. And I bartered the only thing I had to trade. I said, I told God, if you just let me out of here, I promise I'll never be with that girl again. So she was always having dreams that she would get out and surprise me. I mean, I would get out and she would surprise me. And 3 days before I got out, I called the last place I talked to her at. I don't know if I can go here. I said, has anybody talked to KD? And the guy said, nobody's talked to KD. I said, well, have you seen her? So yeah, I saw her yesterday at her funeral. She's dead. She was 18 years old. Her friends dumped her body off on her mom's lawn. I got out, and of course I had to use harder than ever, you know, and I did. I wanted to know why she would choose to die for that, you know, because it's all about me. Why would she choose that over me? So I set out to find out, and that's when I started doing heroin and mixing it with coke, I caught another case. I was in jail, and the probation officer had set up for me to go to treatment. And she's like, I need you to go to treatment. You're going to go right to treatment from jail. And I was like, well, see, I would really like to get out and say goodbye to my family and pack my stuff and all this and that. And she said, yeah, all right, but you got to go right after that, like right after you do that. And I said, yeah, I promise. So I went and hung out with my family for about 30 minutes and went to a friend's house. He gave me some pills. I don't know what they were. I didn't care. Just whatever. I'll find out. And then I drank about half a pint of vodka and then went and got some heroin. And the guy that got it for me went back to the house with me. The girls that I was with, whose house it was, had gone on another mission to go get some coke, and we were all going to meet back at her house. Well, I got there before everybody with this guy, and he hit me, and I died, and he left me there, took my rents and left. And when the girls got back, I was purple, and I'd been gone for a while, so my friend Becca, she breathed for me. You know, actually, she called my friend Sammy, who had given me the pills in the first place. She's like, hey, Ricky's dead. What do I do? She's like, call 911, bitch. And hung up, you know, so she could call. And so she called the ambulance and breathed for me. And Becca's gone now. she was my dope fiend angel, you know. And when the paramedics brought me back with Narcan, I was screaming at them. It was like the worst thing I've ever felt in my life. It was like, if you can imagine a train rolling through your entire being, that's what Narcan felt like. And I was screaming, why'd you wake me up? Because it was like they woke me up from the best sleep I'd ever had. It was the only time I had ever felt rest. And they were like, well, you were gone, sir. And I was like, why did you wake me up? And that didn't get my attention at all. I just started using more. I eventually hit bottom and ended up going to Laha and in 96. It was there that I didn't believe in anything, but there was this part of me that wanted to believe in something, and they were telling me I needed to believe in something. And so I went to this counselor. I was like, they're going crazy, you know. I got this part of me that wants to believe, and I got this other part that just laughs at that part. And he said, well, maybe the part that wants to believe is your heart, and the part that laughs at that part is your head. And that made sense. And he said, so what are you going to believe in? I said, well, I'll believe in the people, you know. He's like, well, that's tangible. I'm like, yeah, that's right. And he's like, what do they have, you know, that you're going to trust in, you put your reliance in? It's like, well, I don't know. And he kind of tricked me. He would distract me with some other stuff, and he would come back to the question, like, so what do they have? And I was like, I don't know, it's power. You know, oh, so it's power. And I was like, no. And I would threaten to leave, like, I'm walking out of here. And he would distract me with some other stuff and come back to the question, like, so what's this power? And it was like, and I hated God. I was the violently anti-religious guy, right? And all of a sudden, my ego just tripped. And I said, the power of God? Like, question mark? And it was nuts. I had that feeling that Bill had in Bill's story. I felt lifted up, but I felt like I was shot out of a cannon up above the stratosphere, coupled with the feeling of every shot of dope, everything, every drug I'd ever done combined. And I was above the stratosphere, and I was looking back, and everything was the clearest I'd ever seen it in my life. That was my first spiritual experience, and it really got my attention, but I didn't put the work behind it. And I ended up in a dope house preaching about how great it was to be sober, you know, on a pink cloud. These people are trying to smoke crack in peace, and I'm preaching to them about how great it is to be sober, and how awesome. And, you know, I was still in the dope house. So when the thought occurred, maybe a little bit of milk with my crack would, you know, make it. And I had this judge promise me. He looks at me and he says, I promise you, if you piss dirty one more time, I'm going to send you to prison for 10 years. And I believed him. And I promised, I will never do this again. And like they say, you could have put me on a lie detector test and I would have passed. But I didn't have the power to make good on that promise. I had traded my parents. We'd all signed papers saying for $400 that I needed for rent at the dope house, I would never contact them ever again. And we all signed papers. My dad had papers drawn up, and it was all legal. And we all signed the papers saying I would never, never, ever call again. And that money was gone in one night. So I promised this judge, and I was in that dope house. And I couldn't even make it to the next probation appointment. I was just going to stop the next day, and maybe I could just drink a lot of water. I could do one of the tricks to pass the UA, and I knew I was screwed. And so I took the magical door, which was rehab in Houston. I went to the Right Step in Houston, and I stayed sober for 6 years. I had this really cool sponsor. He was my friend, you know, and like we hung out all the time. And it took me 2 years to do my first four step. You know, he had just kind of plopped me down and had me do the third step prayer without having me read 60 to 63. I had no idea what I was. I just missed it. I missed the third step altogether. And instead of like, you've been on this for 2 years, like maybe we should just go back and try the third step again. We were good buddies by that time, you know. And so by that time, I was unwilling to be completely honest with this person, and because I was afraid of losing a friend, and so I withheld some stuff that poisoned my sobriety. I had some amazing spiritual experiences in Houston, but they were followed quickly by this thing called aridity, where following a spiritual experience, you go into a state where you feel nothing but pain and fear. And I believed that I was connected, even though I didn't feel a connection. And I relied on that belief instead of doing the work to become aware of the connection again. I created more wreckage in that 6 years sober than in my entire life. I destroyed every relationship I had. It was no longer safe to go to meetings because I had been with so many people's girlfriends. I had people waiting for me at meetings. You know, I couldn't go. You know, I'm sure it was a lot worse in my head than it was in real life, but I didn't feel like I had a place to go anymore. And the thought occurred to me, I could just drink normal. After being a hardcore junkie for 20 years, I'm just going to drink normal. And I did. I drank normal for about 2 months. I would drink and go to bed. You know, wasn't happy, but I could do that until I was driving by Fourth Ward. I was like, you know what they got in Fourth Ward? They got some crack. And so I shot crack for a year. Hold up in my apartment until I got lonely enough to go to the coffee shop and hang out with my old sober friends. That was hell. That was pure hell. Ran out of money, came back to Austin, fell into heroin and meth, and just became immersed, lost in that world for a long time, and almost didn't make it out of that. I stayed out for 5 years. I OD'd about four more times. I went to prison for a year. I thought state jail was just like another jail. Yeah, it's prison. It's actually a little worse than regular prison. I got out of there and started to use again. I couldn't believe that my dad picked me up from prison. He's like, "Where do you want to go?" I was like, "Well, I want to come home." He's like, "Oh, you can't come home. You can't come home with me, you know." But I manipulated my way back into their situation, their life, caused them more pain. I stole my dad's car and wrecked it into a tree on heroin and Seroquel, ran from the scene and climbed back in bed, and they arrested my dad because, you know, the car was in his name. And until they figured out that it was me and they woke me up, I had airbag burns on my arms. And I said, look at me, how would I be driving, you know? And I had to watch the dash cam video with my dad in my attorney's office. And all these cops were calling other cops over. They're like, "Dude, you gotta see this." And he's like, "Watch this. Okay, sir, follow my finger with your eyes." And they would just go like this because my eyeballs are going like that. So I got a DWI for that. That still didn't get my attention. It wasn't until I was hanging out with this using buddy, and we're living in this horrible house, and. We had we had gone and gotten heroin, and he did all his, and I like saved a little bit of mine so I could re-up, and he wanted some of mine, and I said, no, you know, I saved mine so I could re-up. You shouldn't have done all yours, you know? And so so he chased me around the house, and I grabbed some knives and chased him around the house, and he grabbed a rake, and I tried to get away. I got on my bike and started going, like, trying to get away, and he swung that, you know, the hard tip rake, the, you know, you tilt. He just swung it over his head, and boom, just nailed me right here, and just huge rake wound, right? And it was then that I was like, I gotta find some better friends. This is getting out of hand, you know. I called my friend Stephen, who I had known off and on throughout the years, who he had been in and out, and he was sober at the time. And I called him, and I said, I'm done. You know, like you do. I'm done. You know, like you say every morning, right? I'm done. And he was like, I'll know you're done when you call me from treatment. So I went to OSAR, and I got on a list. And the list was about 6 weeks. They weren't going to pay for detox. I was going to have to detox myself, which at this point, I almost got a weird pleasure out of kicking heroin. Like, you know, you just get to feel so sorry for yourself that it's almost nice, you know? And so I kicked heroin one more time, and I still had like 4 weeks to wait for a bed, right? So I got kind of bored, and I went to my friend's house, this married couple, and I did some heroin with some benzos, and they said it was the most violent overdose they'd ever seen. My friends slapped, I was blue. My friend's wife slapped me, and my body just convulsed a foot off the ground, and I went, and then went back out. And they were dragging me to the car, and my head came off the curb, and I woke up. Austin Recovery called me the next day, and they said, this was a Thursday, they said, can you come in Monday? I said, yeah, I think that'd be a good idea. Yeah. I don't know that if I wouldn't have overdosed that night, if I would have been ready for that call. Probably would have had some other plans. I'd written a 4-step in prison. I was in when I was in jail, I had four dope cases on me, and I was still making alcohol in jail, you know. And so I got caught 3 times for making hooch in jail, and my third time, they would lock me down for 7 days each time. And on my third 7-day lockdown, they took everything away from me. They took all my commissary, everything. They said, we lost all your stuff. This is all we found. And they threw a big book in the room. If you're in a room for 7 days, you're going to read by yourself. Yeah. So I read. I read the book. I read it twice. I'd been sober before, so I started saying the 3rd-step prayer in the morning and at night, and my 4th-step just came out. I begged the inmates next to me. I said, y'all got to send me some paper and pen. And I just kept writing. I wrote it. And then they were sending me to prison. I was afraid I was going to lose it in transit. And so I sent it to my dad, which he's the first person on the list. And then to send back to me in prison. And it got lost in the mail like 4 times. But anyway, I still had it when I got out. And I brought it here. And Stephen came out here. And he came out here almost every other day, and he worked me through the book. I did a 5-step with him, and I still omitted that thing that had poisoned my previous sobriety. I still left it out. And so he said, you know, go and take the book down from the shelf and read over the things. And so I did. And I asked for the willingness to let go of anything that I had withheld. And I was given not only the willingness to let it go, but a desperation. And so I called him, and I told him the thing that I was never going to tell anybody. And for the first time, I was free. And when we did my seventh step, I never thought that I would have a spiritual experience that would get my attention or be as that I could be as sure about it as the first one that I had. But when I did my seventh step, that night I had a dream. I was here, and I had a dream that I was going down. I was like tubing with friends or something. I was going down this river, and it was like the clearest water I'd ever seen in my life. And I didn't have to breathe. I was just like cruising through the water like an eel, you know. And when I got to the end of the little river thing where you got to walk back to your car, I realized that I was barefoot. I looked down at my, and I saw my bare feet, which is very rare in dreams. And I saw my feet, and I have a fear of hurting my feet. I have very sensitive feet. Shut up. And I said, I thought in my dream, I said, what about my feet? And my next thought in my dream, which I'd never thought anything like this in a dream, I said, oh yeah, I'm trusting God now. He'll protect my feet. And I just started running. And everywhere I stepped was a flat rock, and I didn't hurt my feet. And when I got back to the car where all my friends were, I told them that little story. And they were like, oh, that's a cool story. But you got this huge leech on your back. And I was like, what? I couldn't reach it. And they're like, that's okay, we'll get it. So I just leaned over and let them, they all pulled this huge leech off my back. And I woke up. I was like, that was a crazy dream. And I came out here and sat right outside that door. And it was a crazy-ass thunderstorm. And I was snuck out here and I was smoking, thinking about the dream, right? And I'm also terrified of electricity, especially lightning. And I swear, lightning hit this building and sounded like a bomb went off. Boom! And there was no fear. For the first time ever, there was nothing, no reaction, no flinch, no nothing. There was no fear. And I was like, that's weird. I just made note of it, went back to sleep. And the next day, in process group, the counselor said, well, I want you to go around and talk about your spiritual experiences. And this guy, I hadn't told anybody about the dream or the lightning. This guy speaks like second or third, and he says, I don't know, I haven't really had that lightning bolt experience yet. I was like, holy shit, I think I have. I had a hard time in sobriety. I'm glad I did, because I stayed very humble. I had created so much wreckage that I was unemployable. I was a felon. I had so much traffic stuff. I didn't think I was ever going to be able to pay it off. And I finally paid it off at like 4 years sober, and I pled to the last thing that I totally forgot about, which was the driving with suspended license. Well, if you've ever refused to blow in Texas, forever and ever, if you get a driving with suspended license, an automatic 2-year suspension. So I got my license suspended for 2 years after not having one for 4. So I didn't get my license free and clear for 6 years. And so I was living in Cedar Park, and I really liked South Austin meetings. And so I would take the bus an hour to downtown, ride my bike to the meetings down south, ride back after the meeting, and take the bus back an hour every day. Or I would beg people for rides. And I had this thing about getting to meetings 30 minutes early. And so I would be like, hey, can you give me a ride to the meeting? And they'd be like, yeah, that's fine. I was like, hey, could we get there 30 minutes early? They're like, who is this guy? I established a practice early of devoting time in the morning and at night to prayer and a lot of reading stuff. And I did that for a long time. I did that for about 6 years before I realized that I was listening to a Mark Houston speaker tape, and he said, "How free do you want to be?" And I realized I'd been free, really free, for 6 years, but really, how free was I? And so I started taking a look at the things I was doing, and I realized that I had developed this spiritual pride around my morning ritual, which was praying this long-ass prayer that had grown over time, and reading a bunch of stuff. And I realized that I had developed this spiritual pride around those things, and I would brag about how great I was at them. You know, I'm so good in the morning and at night, like I do every night, you know. And I realized I wasn't, I was using those things to justify not doing anything else. And so that's when I started to incorporate meditation also. And nightlies. And that really opened up a whole different world to me. It's crazy what the gifts that I've gotten by doing the things I've resisted the most. I hear people say, I don't do that. I'm just not good at that. Well, to me, that's resistance. And I found the most benefit from doing the things that I resist. I've gotten a sponsor. I sponsored a guy who he withheld something, and I told him, "Go home, take the book down from the shelf, pray for the willingness to let go of anything that you've forgotten, and just call me." So he called me. So I left something off. I said, "Yeah, go ahead." So I was partying with this girl in a hotel room, and I gave her too much, and she died, and I left her there. And I thanked him for his honesty. And in his omission, he had set me free. Because I hated those people that left my girlfriend. I wanted to kill them for years. They all moved away. They were terrified. And of all the secrets this guy would have had, I got to see him. I did a fifth step, and I got to see that all of his fears, it was all fear. He wasn't a horrible person. The people that left my girlfriend, they weren't horrible people. They were just afraid. That's something I never expected. I never expected that from some stranger, you know? I don't know, I don't think he's around anymore. But I am. I have over 10 years sober. It started right here. Gratitude has been very close to my higher power. Almost the same. Gratitude has been my connection. And when I'm not grateful, I'm being doubtful. I used to doubt God. I haven't in a long time. I tell people, I recently found my mugshot, and it's absolutely horrifying. I couldn't believe it when I saw it. I looked at it and I was like, no, it must be a different person with my name on there. And it was me. And it's horrifying. And for anybody that's out there that's doubting God, I'd like to offer to show you that mugshot. because it is truly a miracle that I'm here. I died 7 times. I shouldn't be here. So that's why I thank God every day on my knees. Just works. I pray for the people that upset me. That works. I do what works. I do what I don't want to do. I do it for you, and I do it for me. Anyway, thanks.